Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Thank you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't Lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Just ask for justice, I mean, and be very specific about what you're talking about in the past.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there and looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out. Took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people to know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. Coming along, I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses that could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
All right, this morning's live stream is titled Barometers, Metrics, Floating Buildings, Tea Houses, and Clemens Wilson. Hopefully you guys can hear me out there. We had some tech issues. Seems like we've been having them every other day. But anyway, 976-82-2945 if you got any comments or suggestions. Anyway, I was speaking to a high school friend of mine yesterday. And I guess we were, at least the way I translated in my mind, barometers, things that you can see, you can sort of predict the future if you take a look at what's happening right now. Now, see what's happening right now, you know, in your environment, and then if you look in other geographical environments, you know, you can probably predict the future. So I'll point out some of my barometers and metrics, and which will relate to the rest of the topic, floating buildings, tea houses, and then hopefully something inspirational to you guys, a guy named Clement Wilson. In any event, barometers, okay, how you can forecast. Like I said, I was speaking to a high school friend of mine, and he had a limousine company at one time. And due to the fact that he knew the landscape of that industry at the time, and this is many years ago, he morphed his limo company, where he had, you know, a few limousines on the street, you know, we got, you know, drivers and all that. As the industry in a particular town that he was in, because when he got in, there was virtually, it wasn't zero regulation, but it was low regulation to get in to the limousine business. But as more people got into it, it got to be more regulated by the government and harder to earn his, you know, his fees. So he morphed his limo company into becoming a chauffeur. Now let me, and I didn't know this for years, limousine, you're in somebody, you're a chauffeur, not a chauffeur, but you're a driver. You're a driver who essentially, at least at the time he was doing it, all you needed was a driver's license. I don't know what you need now. But you're a driver. You go to work for a limousine company. The company has a limousine that you go out on your assignments for. And you take them to wherever they need to go, then you bring back, drop them off, the customer off, and then you, or the client off, as they call it in that business, and then you bring the limousine back to the garage. All right, so they're drivers. their employees, and they work their shift or assignment, and that's it. Now, so he started out as a driver, then he owned his own limousine company, where he started off with one limousine, and then he had, you know, two, three, four, five of them on to his fleet. All right, but with that, you know, you got to worry about drivers. You know, are they good drivers? Are they coming into work? Are they leaving their assignment? If the drivers are all good, then you also have to deal with maintenance, because cars do require maintenance, oil changes, tires, engines, transmissions, spark plugs, all that type of stuff. So as the industry in this particular city got more regulated, he decided to more of, you know what, he didn't want to do limousines anymore. And from the aspect of owning the company, he said, you know what, I'll morph out to be a chauffeur. Now, a chauffeur is a driver, but he doesn't drive his car. He doesn't work. Typically, many chauffeurs are independent contractors. And if you want to be driven to any place, then the chauffeur is driving a car that you supply. All right? And that can be any kind of car you want. It can be your own personal car. You can get a limo, whatever you want. But the chauffeur is the professional driver that drives your car. All right? So that's how that goes. So he used to earn, just off of one of his clients, $4,000 per week. Now, he put in about close to 16 hours a day to earn that. But, you know, he was doing that quite a number of years for a client. And that was just one of his clients. He had maybe two, three, four at the most, but one of them that's paid him $4,000 a week. So I asked him how that was going, and he said, now here's a barometer, that his business since the advent of apps, particularly with Uber, because Uber is an app, and regulators have not figured out how to regulate an app yet, but Uber is an app. Lyft is an app. I don't know what else they have out here, but they're apps. And, you know, peer-to-peer, you know, car sharing, so to speak, or transportation sharing. So his business has dropped down to 90% of what it used to be. And now he drives, you know, he has his own car, and he does Uber. You know, hopefully he paid off his condo. But with a condo, you still got a condo fee. But, you know, and Airbnb, you know, that app put a dent in the hotel, or the hospitality industry. So, what, and there are different barometers out here. One of the primary barometers that I use to see what's happening with, you know, things that I'm interested in would be YouTube. You know, for instance, here's another barometer. When it comes to housing, I've noticed that Generation Z people, and you can look it up, Generation Z are people like 9 years, well, let's say 9 or 10, since I got my phone here, let's check it out. Age range Generation Z. Range, Gen okay, age range for Generation Z is they were born between 1997 and 2012. 12. So Generation Z folks are ages 10 to 25. That's your Generation Z. So if you go on YouTube, you know, and you check out the barometer for what some of the Generation Z people are doing, some of them, I don't know what the percentages are, but you won't have to look hard for a video. You have Generation Z people that are building houses. They're taking a look at their parents and grandparents that are, let's say, Generation X, Generation X and maybe Baby Boomer twos. And you know what? Even millennials, because millennials were born from 1981 to 1990, so they go from 26 to 41. So you've got Generation Z people, some that are building their own houses. They're looking at, you know what? I don't want a 30-year mortgage. I don't want an FHA. I don't want any type of government sponsored mortgage on my house. I'm going to learn how to build my own house. These are people 10 to 25, Generation Z, that are they're building their own house. So that's why I like YouTube as a barometer. Matter of fact, trying to find an audio for you right now. But you also have, there's a lady, she's about 21, 22 now. But you know what, before we go to that, let me play Lauren Nelson. She's 12 years old now, but listen to this. She was 10 or 11 when this radio was made. She's Generation Z, and listen to what she did.
Welcome to Camp Hugay. Hugay.
This 11-year-old spent her summer turning the inside of this camper from this to this.
I was looking through an American Girl magazine, and I saw a camper for $650 for an American Girl, and it was a very nice camper. My dad said that was really expensive for us, so he said that we could get a real camper for that amount of money. So then I went out and I started looking for one. We saw down the road a house had a camper for sale that I had been looking at for a while. So I really wanted to get it, and the guy said it was for $500. And then I told him $400 because that was what I had, and he said sold.
And the total cost of renovations thus far? $400.
We had looked on Pinterest and saw a lot of cool camper ideas, and I liked this beachy boho style with lots of plants and different colors and sea glass and driftwood, that style. So I liked that, and we decided to paint the camper walls white and then our kitchen cabinet turquoise. So this is my dining area. I got this from our potting shed that had dust and dead flies all over it, so we cleaned it up and that's what we got. We planted some plants from Dollar General in there. We have all of this on the backside came from our house except for that one picture back there from Dollar General. And a fun fact about these, this table and these cabinets, they flip down into a bed, and so does this. And then over here we have the kitchen where we can't quite cook stuff yet, but it's very decorative. And this is our refrigerator. This is the inside of it. And then if we walk a little further down, we have right here, these are very nice decals that we got for a dollar at the Dollar Tree. And then if we walk a little bit farther in here, we have a mirror that we painted the edges that came with the camper originally. And we have a closet over here, and it's the one little camper I got this side from my neighbor who made it for me. And then we keep walking, and now we're in the bedroom. So we have four beds in here, and we got these really cute mattresses off of Etsy.
She painted most of it herself. She had her grandma come over the one day and help with the cupboards, but I would be gone for the day, and I'd come home, and she'd say, like, you could tell, and I'd say, how long were you in here? And she's like, oh, I painted about 4 hours straight.
Well, I'm very creative and artistic, so I love to paint and draw and stuff like that, so it kind of came to me naturally.
With this COVID thing, it's kind of interrupting her fun that she wants to have in it, but she's making the best of it.
Lauren hopes to be able to have friends over soon, but a chance to get away from home works for now.
I hope you enjoyed my camper tour. Thanks for stopping by.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
All right, so that's Lauren Nelson. She's Generation Z. And is she an outlier? No. She's 12 years old right now, but if you go on YouTube, and once again, YouTube, I use that to spot very, I use YouTube as a primary barometer to observe other barometers and metrics going on locally as well as globally. So if you go on YouTube, and if you go to YouTube and you want to see that, you know, the video part of that, the visual part of that audio I just played, just type in Lauren, L-A-U-R-E-N, Lauren Nelson. Put Lauren Nelson tiny house or Lauren Nelson camper or Lauren Nelson 11-year-old, and then she's got about three videos, including that one that tell her story that she just shared. But she's just 12 years old right now. All right. And that's something that she – now, she can – you got people doing that. So that's Generation Z. Like I said, they're looking at their parents that are Generation X or Baby Boomer 2, and they don't want a 30-year mortgage. They don't want to be, you know, working two or three jobs to keep a roof over their head and their kid's head. So it's not only Lauren, but if you look in, put in 13-year-old tiny house, 15-year-old tiny house, and videos will pop up of 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds that are building tiny, debt-free homes. Now, another barometer on YouTube, again, is, and this is always, this is Generation Z as well. There's a lot going on with Generation Z. And Generation Z are people 10 years old to 25. There's a young lady, her YouTube channel is Marie TV, M-A-R-E-E, Marie TV, all one word. And Marie, now Marie might be 20, 21 years old now. However, and I think I have her audio on here, but I'm going to suggest you go to her channel directly on YouTube. Now, here's why she's a barometer. Okay. And I want you to pay close attention to her metrics the way I'm going to explain them. Marie, when she was either 15 or 16, she got pregnant, teen pregnancy. Now, Marie didn't go to the social services office. She didn't get on welfare or anything like that. But instead of going to the social services office, what Marie and I believe her mother did was they went and bought a shed, a garden shed. And then they converted the shed into a tiny house. Oh, and Marie, she had the child, I guess, 17 years old in the video on YouTube. So now I'm saying that Marie is a barometer, and her metric is, instead instead of going to the government, now I'm not knocking the government, instead of going to the government, going to social services, which is some people's metric sustainability, she took a turn and went to wherever she bought that shed because, no Section 8 for Marie. And she bought a shed. She owned the shed outright, 100%. It's not being taxed because it's not classified as real estate. It's personal property. She owns it outright. That's another metric that many Generation Z people are going for. They don't want real estate. They want housing that they can own outright. And a shed provides that because a shed is not real estate. It's not permanently attached to the ground. So Marie went out, bought a shed, and she converted it into a tiny house. That's where her and her son live. Now, if you go to, not Facebook, if you go to YouTube and look up her channel, Marie TV, M-A-R-E-E, one word, M-A-R-E-E, TV, all one word, and she's got maybe two or three, maybe four now. She's got a variety of things on her channel, but what you're looking for, and you might want to type it into the YouTube search engine, Marie TV Tiny House. And you want the very first tiny house video that she made, because then she goes through the process of what she did to convert. And the tiny house is parked in her parents' backyard. So her tiny house has a living area. It has a kitchen area. You know, it has a loft, and everything. And like I say, her and her son live in there. She doesn't have a bathroom. But it's her tiny house, which she owns outright, as a teen mom. She's like 20, 21 years old now, I guess. But she owns it. Where Section 8, you don't own nothing. Social service, anything you get from social services, I'm not knocking social services, you don't own anything. So Marie TV, when you get to, YouTube, put in Marie TV, once again, M-A-R-E-E, TV, one word, tiny house, and then look for, she's heard probably about three or four tiny house videos on there. She's got a bunch of content, but you want to look at her tiny house videos, particularly the very first one or two where she goes through the conversion when she was like 17 years old. Before she did all this before she was 18. Since then, she's, put herself through school, raising her son. So she's done some amazing things. And I'm looking at that. This is a young black girl, a woman too, young lady. Very good example of instead of going to, and once again, I'm not knocking social services or Section 8. You got to do what you got to do. You do what you know, what you can do. But I'm just saying, looking at the barometer, okay, as more people, no matter what color or no matter what sex, they see stories like Marie and look at that barometer and look at her wealth metric, then they'll be doing what she owns her own home. Matter of fact, talk about generational wealth. Her son, who's not even 5 years old yet, he's got a debt-free home due to what his mother did at 17. By buying a shed and fixing it up. So take a look at that. That's another barometer. I got a text yesterday. Before I get into that, floating buildings. Now, Marie has a floating, she took the shed. Sheds are floating buildings. My definition of a floating building is any building that is not permanently attached to land and is not classified as real estate. It's mobile. It could be on wheels. It could be on skids. You can deconstruct it, put it on the back of a flatbed or a U-Haul, ride a truck or whatever. Those are floating buildings. That's where teepees are floating buildings. Yurts are floating buildings. It looks like more of the population are becoming nomads, and or if they're not nomads, they're living in floating buildings, something that they own 100% outright, but it's not classified as real estate. They're not assessed property taxes. They don't take municipal water. They can't be foreclosed on. They can't be foreclosed. No bank has any parts of this. Marie bought her shed for cash. She fixed it up, and she converted it from a shed to a house with nothing dealing with the government. No FHA, no VA, none of that. She did that after she gave birth as a teen. So if Marie could do it and Lauren Nelson can do it, I'm looking at anybody can do it. Now, you're going to have to pick up some skills like they did, but if they can do it, we can all do it. All right. Now, so it's both Laura and her, the common denominator between those two young ladies is they both have floating buildings, a roof over their head, but it's not classified as real estate, therefore they don't have to pay. They don't have to deal with the high property taxes that their parents and their grandparents had to deal with. Now that leads me to tea houses. I got a text yesterday about tea houses, and I once again go to YouTube. That's my favorite primary barometer, and look up tea houses, TEA houses, and it's just one particular video that I watched. This guy, I think he has like 3 tea houses. That's what he calls them. And they all have a different purpose or function on this guy's particular plot of private land. All right, so those are some of the barometers on that. When we come back in a few minutes, we're going to talk about Clemens Wilson. And, you know, he didn't have access to the electronics and the Internet and all the stuff we got, the gadgets we have today. But he did something by just reading the barometers that was right in front of his face.
I'd say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back out the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax Wrestling House. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
All right, well... That's what I call my nine friends audio. But that's a barometer, too, where you're noticing small groups of people. They can be anybody, you know, any color, any race, or any religion, or what have you. And that was an example of cooperative economics. You know, guy buys a house on the cheap for the back taxes. The house has been sitting in a neighborhood for quite some time, and none of the neighbors do any, you know, they don't. Any one of those neighbors in that neighborhood could have bought that house years ago. So they bought the house, and, you know, that's an example of how gentrification happens. And Baltimore, Maryland, you've got, maybe 55,000 buildings. There's a lot of vacant buildings up there. Cleveland, Ohio, a lot of vacant buildings. A lot of your urban buildings, I mean urban cities, particularly east of the Mississippi, you know, Buffalo, New York, Indianapolis, you know, they have, you know, Rochester, New York, vacant buildings. Some of those have been vacant for 20-plus years. And one of the ways that a neighborhood gets gentrified is just what you just heard. They got into the building on the cheap, and then he invited. Now, I call that audio nine friends, but in reality, that more than likely, because let's do the mathematics on this. Nine pickup trucks showed up. So that's you got nine drivers, and then let's say at least one person was in each one of those trucks as a passenger. So that's 18 people. 18 plus the guy who bought the house, and I'm just assuming he bought it by himself. I don't know if they all, you know, people, he got a group of people together. 18 people in 12 hours. And the house goes from nobody wanted it on the block to it looks like a brand new house, inside and out. That's been quietly happening for decades, and it just, you know, it continues to happen. But anybody can do that. Now, that was a house. You can use that same idea of getting together with your friends and buying 40 acres. If you want to do that, you know, 40 acres with 18 people, man, that, you know, let's do the math on it. You got 40 acres, and you got 18 people. That's 22 people. Each one of them gets an acre of land. And you got 22 acres left over. And an acre is about the size of a football field. So everybody gets an acre. And then, you know, we got 22 acres left over. I mean, it's only limited to your imagination of what you can use that for. Okay, to grow food, entertainment. Oh, man, it's only limited to your imagination. All right, so, all right, now, Clement Wilson, because the name of the title of today's podcast is Barometers, Metrics, Floating Buildings, Tea Houses, and Clement Wilson. So let's get to Clement Wilson. Clement Wilson was, and I just heard about this guy for the first time, about 2 hours ago. But everybody's heard of his the business that he started, which was Holiday Inn. Clement Wilson, from what I understand, was a carpenter. Now let me read his story here. And he's the originator of Holiday Inn. Anyway, Clement Wilson. Wilson initially came up with the idea of Holiday Inn at a family road trip to Washington, D.C., during which he was disappointed by the quality of roadside hotels in that era, of that era. So that was a barometer for him. He didn't have, you know, the smartphones that we have today or laptops or tablets or desktops. He didn't have any of that stuff. But he used what he saw in plain sight. So he didn't like the lack of, you know, because I imagine he was on the road with his family. It was a family road trip. They want a family holiday. And, you know, somebody may have needed to go to the restroom, so he didn't find anything locally on the road, no gas stations even, places to eat, none of that. And then when he did run across something, the quality wasn't there. So that was his barometer. Okay. So the name Holiday Inn was given to the original hotel by his architect, Eddie Bluestein, as a joke. Let's see. In any event, here's a guy who was a carpenter, and he was on a family vacation, not looking to start a business, not looking to get into the hotel or the motel business. But due to the fact that he couldn't find anything suitable for his family, all right, on the roadsides back then, he said, you know what, I can build me, and that's what he did. He got a blueprint, got a carpenter, built a house, you know, and of course the name stuck. So, Clement Wilson, and I'm sure some of you have ideas out there that that can rival that as well. I mean, he quick, after he did the first one, he just thought, you know, because he was thinking about when he was on that road trip, somebody in a motorcycle drove past the house. But he just thought, you know what, I drove all those miles and nothing, I'm going to start a chain. So after he built the first one, then he was thinking bigger, and he got ahead of the curve because he realized somebody else might try to copy his, you know, something quality. And, you know, Holiday Inns are very basic. But then he turned it into a chain. So I think before he passed away, he got it up to like 1,000. He went from 0 to 1,000. It took him some years to do that, but that's the story behind Holiday Inn. So, those are some of the things I go by. Not all of them, but YouTube is a excellent place for you to check out, you know, what's on the horizon. Like, for instance, if you go to Japan right now, parts of Asia, you'll see things over there that won't probably be over here for the next 5 to 10 years. And you can also go to Africa, rural Africa. You can go to rural Africa, and you'll see some things that they're doing there that they're not doing here yet. I look at the United States and a lot of Western countries as retail markets, but a lot of innovation markets are in developing countries. So a lot of people say, oh, wait a minute, I see something innovative here in some parts of Zimbabwe, And matter of fact, I'll give you a good example. There's a young man, I've tried to get him on here, I got to keep on trying, William Wakamba. William is originally from Malawi. And in Africa, particularly rural Africa, you know, to go to school, your parents had to pay school fees. No school fees, no school. So his parents couldn't afford to pay school fees. So to keep himself occupied, William used to go to the village library in his, you know, his village in Malawi. And in that library, you know, which is, you know, full of donated books, he found a book on how to make windmills. And the reason why I'm sharing this story is it's all about barometers. It's all about barometers, particularly if you're looking for innovation within barometers. The barometers here are rural Africa. The second barometer within this story is innovation. Okay, let me continue with the story. So he found a book on how to make windmills to generate electricity. So he read the book. He didn't have no internet like we do. No flip phones, no smartphones, no tablets, no desks, nothing but that book. And he went to a junkyard in his village in Malawi, or near his village in Malawi, and he took, talk about, and I think I mentioned this yesterday, but let me go back into detail on this here today. If you're in need of anything in your life, here's some basic, I'm going to call them spiritual slash practical principles of life. Start where you are. William Wakamba started where he was, in a rural village in Malawi with no money, no engineering background, no internet connection, no electronics. He started off with a book on how to build windmills. The next thing is, and he used that book because the next thing he did was he went to a junkyard and he found parts there to put together a windmill. And if you look up The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, he wrote a book about this, but put in The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind or William Wakamba, and there's a picture of his very first windmill. It's a windmill. All right, once again, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. He did what he could with the instructions in the book, the pictures in the book, and what he found in the junkyard. He built a windmill in his village, and his house in his village was the first house in his village to have electricity. First one. It's a very crude looking. It's the picture of it's online. That's what I'm saying. Look up The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. Now, long story short, and this is what I call African innovation. I use it as a barometer. He got swept up. He got swept up by white folks, and I'm not saying anything to be racial or racist or whatever, but I'm just saying it's a shame that no HBCU picked up on this guy in his story. He got a scholarship to Dartmouth, Ivy League. I think he's graduated by now. He got a scholarship to Dartmouth. Walt Disney made a movie about this guy. The name of the movie is named after the book, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. It still might be on, Netflix. But if it's not on Netflix, I'm sure you can find it on YouTube Movies. You probably have to rent it. I bought it. I bought a digital copy of it. Or Amazon. The Boy Who Harnessed. Rodney picked up on the story. So he has an e-book, he has an audio book, but the reason why I bring up William Makamba is because if you want to see, put it this way, you're going to see more and more people. You already have it out there, but you're going to have more and more people that you're going to see windmills outside their homes, and they're generating electricity using wind power. It's out there already, but this is just a fascinating story how this guy in contemporary times, just those three rules. Start where you are. He was in rural Africa, rural Malawi, where nobody had electricity. They was using kerosene and candles in that village at the time. There was no electrical grid. All right. Use what you have. All he had was that book and the junkyard. But those two things gave him what he needed, all he needed to build a windmill to generate electricity. And he did what he can, you know, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. And his story got out, and shame that no HBC didn't pick up on that, but HBCU. But anyway, it is what it is. Dartmouth did, and Disney did. Shame that Spike Lee didn't pick up on the movie, or Tyler Perry didn't pick up on the movie. I mean, his story. And there's a lot of innovation like that. In various developing countries, but Africa's got a lot of them. So go to Kindle and get the book, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. You got the printed part or the audio. And like I say, there's a movie too. All right, here's another audio on African innovation. Some of these ideas you can do right here in the United States.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the clients. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us, we have a shaver. so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Because it's cold, the beer tastes better, and so I get more customers.
All right, that's another... if you want to watch the video of that portion of that, once again, my primary barometer, YouTube, go to YouTube and put in Rural Energy Foundation, and that video will pop up, or put in Solar Now, Rural Energy Foundation, Solar Now, and the two versions of that video with music or whatever. But put in Solar Now, Solar Now, S-O-L-A-R, Now, N-O-W, or Solar Now is one word, S-O-L-A-R, N-O-W, one word, Rural Energy Foundation. Put that in, and you'll see the visual part of that video. Now, I've been playing this video on this channel, here on Blog Talk, for about 8 years. I've been on 8 years, 8 consecutive years, going on 9 in December. And the stuff that you hear in that video, or on that audio I just played, for the most part, this is why I love Africa. They're so far ahead of the game when it comes to certain things, because they have to be innovative. That haven't even hit over here yet, or Canada. I mean, one of the things that was played in the video, a solar barbershop. I haven't seen one of those over here yet. A solar hair salon for the ladies. I haven't seen one of those over here yet either. Their marketing. Their marketing, their price structure, and it's just not them. It's just not solar now. But here's another thing that you can look up on the YouTube barometer. Type in Solar Sister. Now, when I look at Solar Sister, it's like looking at, you know what, Madam C.J. Walker, Madam C.J. Walker, how she marketed her product, or how Mary Kay Cosmetics market their products now. Now, get a visual on this. Now, once again, Solar Sister, look that up on YouTube. All right, they got very simplified marketing. Now, what Solar Sister does is they market solar products, solar energy products, you know, lights and things of that nature. You know, and these ladies are earning an income from it. They got families to feed. Now, imagine if you take what they're doing with Solar Sister, okay, imagine Mary Kay's sales force, but now it's a Solar Sister sales force, where you have women that are going into households, you know, with their Mary Kay presentations, instead of doing Mary Kay presentations, instead of doing Tupperware presentations, they're doing things to promote how you can eliminate your electric bill. That's what Solar Sister's doing now that they're not doing over here yet. That's why I love watching stuff out of developing countries, particularly the whole continent of Africa, where you see these barometers or these metrics, and you think, you know what? I can take what they're doing there and then do it over here. Were you anywhere in the United States or Canada? Or many other parts of the Western Hemisphere. If you guys have any comments on barometers, metrics, floating buildings, tea houses, Clement Wilson, or Solar Sister. Okay. We'll be right back right after this.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word, because as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo, because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, And the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck you. Let's go across the street.
I ain't called it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-WAC movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
All right, well, that's the last order we have for you for today. Today's podcast has been Barometers, Metrics, Floating Buildings, Tea Houses, and Clement Wilson is a hodgepodge here for you. Hope you now, once again, check out Lauren Nelson. Put in Lauren Nelson Tiny House in your any search engine, and you know, you'll probably find some newspaper articles are written out about her, but Lauren Nelson Tiny House or Camper, Lauren Nelson Camper, she's a, what I would call a Generation Z metric on the YouTube barometer. Marie TV, M-A-R-E-E TV, one word, on YouTube. And look up, you want to get her tiny house videos. She took a shed and turned it into a house to live in for her and her son. It's got everything except for a bathroom, but it's in her parents' backyard. That's part of the barometer. That is a metric. That's not only where the ball is going, but that's where the ball has landed. You know, and she showers just like in college. You know, in college you got a room. She's got a house. It's a debt-free house. And if she needs to shower, she just goes inside her and her son for that. But there are other people that have converted sheds in the houses, and they have, you know, a full bathroom in their home. And there's one other metric. Now, this comes from, oh, here it is. Let me see, because we got a little time left here. I want to get the title right. Okay. All right, on YouTube, let me see. Now, this is over in England. Oh, I got to lower the sound on this. Okay. Here's what I want you to look up. The lady's name is Katrina with a C. Katrina Davies, not Davis, but Davies. C-A-T-R-I-N-A. Katrina Davies. And you want to look up her video on YouTube titled, Why I Live in a Shed. Okay. She's probably got more than one video, but Why I Live in a Shed. And I believe she has a book. Let me check in my little library here. Let's see. Katrina, spelled with a C. Katrina Davies. Not Davis, but Davies. Okay. I'm not getting it that way. Let me see. She's got a book, too. Oh, man. Where? Okay, wait, let me. I'm playing with keywords here. Okay, let me go back to YouTube. Okay, the name of her video was Why I Live in a Shed. Man, wait a minute. Let me see. Here's another video of a woman living. There's a bunch of women living in sheds. Okay, I just ran across another one. I'm looking for a book. This lady lives in a 10 by 11 shed. It reads, woman living in a 10 by 11 shed converted into a tiny house. Let's see. All right, shed. Hold it. Living in shed. I'm just pressing in tiny words. Let's see what it comes back with. No, it's not. That's not it. Well, there's a bunch of people living in shit. Okay. There's a bunch of people on YouTube that are single women, couples or whatever, but there's a lady who wrote a book about it. Okay, I think I found it this time. Let's see. Yeah, we're back to Katrina Davies. Okay. Here's another video, Why I Chose to Live in a Derelict Shed. Katrina Davies. Let me see. Katrina Davies books. Because she's got a book out on this. Check out the video, you know, for instant gratification. Davies. Okay, here we go. I found it. All right, Katrina Davies, that's C-A-T-R-I-N-A, Katrina Davies, D-A-V-I-E-S, D-A-V-I-E-S, Katrina Davies. And the book, Why I Live in a Shed. Why I Live in a Shed, this is a hardcover. Let me go to Amazon. I was just on Amazon. All right, oh, I was on Kindle, though. Okay, the book, where I missed it. Okay, it's in hardcover and paperback. I don't think there's no Kindle version of it yet. That's why I couldn't find it on Kindle. The name of the book, the full name is, of the title of the book is Homesick, one word, Homesick, Why I Live in a Shed by Katrina Davies. D-A-V-I-E-S. Katrina spelled with a C, not a K. Yeah, the name of the book is available in hardcover for $33. It's available in paperback for $12.56. She lives in England, and the name of her book is, and look at the videos, because the videos you actually see the home. But the book is titled Homesick, that's one word. Homesick, Why I Live in a Shed by Katrina Davies. Okay, that's a barometer, people. And I look at women, I'm looking at, you know what, women's happy meter, because men will live anywhere, okay? But I'm looking at these videos, I'm looking at, here's Lauren Nelson. Now, she's still She's a young lady. She's 12 years old now. Marie TV, she might be 20 now, or 19 or 20. But Katrina Davies is older. And I'm the common denominator with all these ladies, females, is they're happy campers. No pun intended. And we go along, us men go along with whatever makes them happy. Well, you know, that's what we go with. Lauren Nelson, Maria, Marie TV, and Katrina Davies. Three different ages of women, females, over there women, young ladies, I'll say young ladies, that's a blanket. Different parts of the world. Two are here in the United States, but they live in different areas. Katrina Davies is over in England, and it's not cheap to live in England. Three barometers. The common denominator with these three. Number one, zero debt. Zero debt. Common denominator number two, I don't know how the system works in England, but they have housing probably owned outright, but it's not real estate. Real estate has a housing component in it, but you can have housing like a mobile home or something that anything that you live in that you can move. It doesn't have to be a mobile home, but it's considered personal property. But they're debt-free. Now, Lauren's, you know, quite young, but when she does get old enough to date, and Marie, she's old enough to date, and Mary, and Katrina Davies is older than all of them, but there are going to be disagreements in every relationship, but I'm going to tell you this. I very seriously think that these ladies will ever have a fight over rent payments or mortgage payments. They will never have to go to, they might end up in social services some kind of way, but it won't be because they don't have a roof over their head. And Marie and what's her name, Lauren, or even Katrina, you know, they can basically go out and start a cottage industry teaching other ladies or young ladies on how to do the same thing, if they so choose to do so. I don't know what they're doing now, but, you know, follow them, get the book. You know, these are just some of the barometers that are out here within the big barometer of all right, well, if you got any questions, comments, or whatever, be quick about it. 619-768-2945. If you don't, we'll end it here for today. And hopefully you can pick at least one of these ideas on here that you can run with. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.